I was going to say Happy New Year, but in fact, I think I've talked to both of you already. So, Happy New Year again.
New Year.
Yeah, 2026 still sounds weird.
Yep.
don't know. 2025 was a little rough around the edges. So, hopefully, 2026 is a good year for everyone. Better year.
I'm sure the 26 will be just amazing.
My aunt said when 2025 rolled around, and she said we're gonna thrive in 2025. And so I've been waiting for her to tell me what the 2026 slogan is. But have yet to find out. I don't know if we're gonna have Jakob today.
Sounds like it depends if you can find a power bank.
Yeah, that sounded rough. But I can share my screen here and we can get started. Okay. I know everyone's probably just kind of settling back in, but let us see where we can get to today. There's probably some stuff here I need to close that has resolved itself or been resolved in other ways, but all right. Ian, I know that we're still waiting on to hear from Trove about decommissioning these inactive tenants, but how are things going for you otherwise? What's going on?
I'm mostly working on sort of operations for existing systems right now, less in development. We've got the vFind update, and we need to update databases for reshare. And I assume there will be more work coming down for this reshare 2 type environment. I just don't know what it is yet. So that'll probably be coming from Jakob and the developers, I suppose, but nothing to really report on right now.
Thanks. I was wondering about that the reshare database upgrade that you have to do, and the updating of the apps. I thought that Trove was running on the Case and Elia stuff already, so I didn't know if they were going to need the full thing or just the
They
database
would just need
upgrade.
the database update then.
Okay. I guess that, I don't think that totally like changes that the process or anything, but I was just wanting to understand that a little better.
Right. I mean, presumably, I don't know if it's actually, presumably Postgres 16, you'd have to use the Q version. I think I've run it with older versions as well. Like, I don't know if it breaks anything, but it would be better to update.
Okay. And then if you don't mind, I have a question for you about mod DMS, which I know you probably haven't thought about in
No. Yeah, all
a
good.
minute. We're working on an ebook ILL pilot, and one of their questions was if the file upload like mod DMS setup that we have for Trove has any like DRM controls, or like could have, if we added them, or if that's not really like what that system is for.
I guess I'd have to look up what exactly a DRM control is. The way that mod DMS works is it just gives them a unique and obscure link, so it's security through obscurity. It's fairly light on that, and that was determined to be enough for Trove. Basically, there's a link that's really hard to guess, and we could share it with you. But that's all it does, if I
Yeah,
recall.
so it doesn't like control like use
It doesn't
or
like self-destruct after 10 days or anything like that, or tell
but it could
anybody
be
to share
used
it
to
with someone
distribute a
else.
file that had that.
Sure, yeah. I guess I just don't know exactly what I'm not up to date on that. DRM stuff. I should look into that before I talk more.
But yeah, no, we
But there's
didn't do any of
nothing
that. And
currently built
yeah,
in,
it's
right?
not right. And I don't think there's like a global open standard for how that's set. It's all proprietary stuff. Like a lot of them use like Adobe or Overdrive or whatever.
The closest thing that seems to be emerging is that LCP stuff like Rhydium and Thorium, which has been on my list to read up on for 2 months now. And I'm feel sorry that I haven't done it because we've got this meeting coming up this later this morning, Mallory. But I think that something has to be applied on top of just providing access to the book. The CDL approach is to just provide access on the web and then have a web application that just shows a page at a time or 2 pages at a time, so you can flip them. And that makes it at least very awkward to copy the book. And I think that what Rhydium and Thorium does is more like conventional DIM, so that there is some type of encryption applied and it can be consumed on a device with some app that
Some
it comes with and
more
such.
actual.
Yeah, a little more like the stuff we did for that everybody does for CDL is more like, oh, we're just going to make it really awkward to. We're just going to show you a page at a time and make it awkward to get the whole thing.
It looks like these are both for EPUBs, so I guess you'd have to
Yeah.
be dealing with EPUBs. So.
The tr assumption is, I think, that we're doing a project with NYU and Lehigh and a few others at this point that is based on the idea that there are certain collections of books that the libraries have licensed to provide access to. And so the assumption is that they will have them probably as EPUBs and maybe in some cases as PDFs.
I don't know this for sure, but I believe many, if not all, of the more actual proprietary DRM schemes have had some key material leak, and people can strip that from resources anyways. So in reality, it's all just making it more awkward.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think the folks who, that's how the AI companies got all the books. And Mike has a vast collection of pirated books. But I'd also, as I recall having read that it got a lot easier with the later versions of, I think it was it Amazon's that were leaky. I think they kind of fixed it, which was frustrating because it's like a little bit of a right to own, a right to repair type thing where people feel like they've bought a book, they should have the right to put it on their computer in a non-DRM form. And I think that's gotten harder.
So do you think it's, would be our responsibility just to meet leaky industry standards or to really make this, totally bulletproof?
I think the assumption has been that there's a good enough and that what's been done with CDL might actually be good enough. But it's also, part of it is trying to figure out what is a good enough flavor of this that we can make available that will let us do a pilot. And the bigger goal would be, is there something that libraries can do that they can have ownership of and that is as trustworthy as Overdrive or Libby? And that's sort of the bigger goal, but I think to just kind of get us, keep us in the game. I think it would be sufficient to have a way of just providing kind of awkward access to a book. I was looking, there's an EPUB.js thing that I was dying to play with at some point. That's out there and that will load up an EPUB one chapter at a time in JavaScript and render the pages decently nicely in a way that's flowable and mobile friendly. And building a temporary access mechanism into that JavaScript library seems like it would be pretty easy to do. And that could be one way to sort of build a little, you can almost imagine like a little elanding layer or skin on top of mod DMS.
Yeah. What is the image thing? What is it? Triple I? Does that have an
Triple IF.
expiry?
It wouldn't be applying here. We use IIIF for the CDL stuff because the CDL stuff was all scanned books. So they came as page images, basically.
Gotcha.
The thing we built with the Boston Library Consortium would break a PDF of scanned images up into individual images and then used IIIF to render them in a kind of a JavaScript widget that
Right.
provided that sort of browsy kind of feel. And IIIF was just the API that widget was using to get access to the page images. And it did include a mechanism that would turn off access to those images once the loan wasn't in play anymore. But nothing to prevent the download. So anyone could kind of write a IIIF client in JavaScript. And I guess assuming that they could navigate the course stuff, they would be able to crawl it and suck it down.
It's kind
The
of like, I guess
difference.
it's getting more into legal things now, but it's like if it's displaying on your screen, there's some way to get it, I guess. So how much do you have
Especially
to?
these days when it's as easy as running images through an LLM.
Right. Or just, I mean, after, screenshots, whatever, you can
100%. Well, if
copy.
you have a book, if you bought a print book, you can scan it pretty easily, right?
Right.
With your phone,
Yeah.
and you have all those rights without having signed an end user license.
Yeah.
So if
But
you
it's
really want to
inconvenient.
pirate books, then probably the way to go is to buy them and scan them.
So the thing is, so that one, your browser's requesting each image as a separate file. And so you can go into DevTools and save the pages one by one, but it's pretty annoying and you have to write a script. If we use that EPUB.js thingy, you can go into DevTools and save the EPUB, which is a much lower bar in terms of inconvenience.
It is, although the as far as I could tell, the one saving grace might be that my impression of an EPUB is that it is a bunch of HTML files and not atypically one per chapter. So it doesn't actually would it would not typically load the whole book into the browser, but it would load a chapter at a time, and then that's what it's flowing. So you'll actually sometimes see it if you're reading an EPUB that it has sort of an odd, there's an odd thing that goes on when it goes from one chapter to the next in terms of flowing. So that's at least something. I guess if you wanted to be more refined than that, you'd have to go and somehow sign the application or have some kind of handshake between the JavaScript application. It would, this I guess my hunch would be that simply having an application that renders it, and yes, it's a lower bar and what you get out of it is a higher quality product, but the reality is that these EPUBs find a way into the wild anyway. So it has sort of felt in conversations like this it would be good enough. But if we wanted to do something sort of cool sounding, then we would add a layer of encryption and do fancy stuff on the in that browser widget.
Which you could do in kind of like a really easy, really useless way of you distribute the key anyways. It's there for people to save, but they actually have to find it in the compressed, obfuscated JavaScript,
Right.
which would take a sec.
Or maybe you spread it across multiple variables or something in the compressed JavaScript. Just split it up into 10 different constants.
But again, you can
Why
ask the LLM, how
not?
does this do it?
Yeah, that's true. But it's, I mean, so the step beyond that is what they do for Netflix and stuff, where the money is bigger, and where it's my impression that it goes all the way down to some type of proprietary hardware extension type stuff.
Yeah,
So
which
there's
goes back to
some,
DVDs.
yeah, there's something hardware level going on that is not, as far as I know, done for ebooks when they're rendered in the in browser. Actually, if you can read a, I wonder what's going on if you're reading your Kindle ebook on the computer. How much is actually how protected that is? I would be willing to bet that they don't do too much.
which is why they can strip it. But they're trying. Like they have, for some of the video stuff, they have that, what is it, HDCP or something? Like they encrypt stream all the way to the display. So you have to disassemble a monitor basically to get the keys in.
So I don't, my impression has been that we can get away with less for books. So sorry, Mel, that's a detour. But there, I mean, I think the short technical answer is that the mechanism we have right now doesn't have anything built in, but we can add a layer of something. We need to have sort of consensus about what that layer should be. But one
Yeah.
option would be that we could add a layer of based on a standards EPUB reader, or we could explore. Do some kind of feasibility study based on iridium and thorium and write up a proposal. Maybe that's a way to play it with the folks. Do you think it'll come up in the
Yeah.
conversations at 10?
I don't know. this, it might like I sometimes they ask these questions in the metadata meetings, and sometimes they ask them in the fulfillment meetings, and so I'm never quite sure what to expect them to hit us with. But I know that they did ask last time about mod DMS having DRM control, so I just thought I would ask about it here. But I think like I think today's meeting is about fulfillment, and I'm not sure that they've gotten any like furthered any of those conversations since we last talked, about like I think they were going to talk about two different use cases and consider if we could use the CDL workflow. I don't know if this is the meeting where Alan's going to talk about that. But they had also asked me to talk to Minitex about article exchange and how that workflow is working out. They're gonna write something up for me to share back, but I don't have it yet. And then I don't know, like while we're on this topic, Wayne had asked me if we needed, I had originally said we're gonna load the records into a new reservoir. And we're going to apply two separate match keys, and one of the match key sets is going to get sent to share VDE for their clustering, and then we're going to do Gold Rush on the other set, and we'd have two view finds, sort of like we did for CCLP with two different match keys applied. And I thought we would just have those view finds point to their production reshare tenants so that they could place test requests, since we don't have a PALSY or like a test environment for PALSY. And Wayne asked me if we should consider if they want to be doing like this testing, if we should consider having a separate reshare environment to test. And I don't know if any of you have feelings on that. I mean, obviously, it'd probably be better to do testing in a test or a dev environment rather than in their production environment. But I don't know what if that's a big extra lift or if that simplifies things somehow. Or yeah.
Where is this going to land eventually? Like, is it included in the reshare that PALSY is running, or is it something else?
I think it's going to be incorporated into their production, the current production PALSY viewfind and reshare workflow. But Seb, if that's wrong, please correct me.
What I think everybody would hope. Sooner or later. I guess the question might become how disruptive is the space between sooner or later going to be? If there's going to be development of new workflows, then we're not really going to want to roll those into any production, right? So we're not going to want to test them in production. So if you imagine
Right.
flow where we are progressively adding, there's going to be some phase coming up this year where we're going to be adding functionality to ModRS to deal with these, or maybe it'll turn out that for the purposes of this, it is going to be sufficient to use the non-returnable, the UIL supply mechanism. Because there's one scenario here where in the short term, the assumption is that the delivery and access to the ebooks will live completely outside of reshare. Maybe not even in using mod DMS, but in some platform outside. And the supplying library is just providing a UIL. In that situation, I guess we just turn on the copy mechanism and we use that for fulfillment of ebooks.
Right, that functionality is already in the production Palsy setup. They just don't use it, but like the copy functionality and supplying via URL is already present there. But if we do any other workflow, like you said, other workflow development or change things, then yeah, we wouldn't roll that directly into prod.
I wonder if a low friction initial step is to let them test the copy flow in the existing system, and if we start to do any development of something else that we don't even really know what is, but maybe we'll come up with something this morning with the SMEs, but then we set up a separate test environment for that. Or let people test in Cardinal somewhere.
Yeah, right. Cardinal. Okay. Well, I think yeah, I guess let's see what they are think. If they think the copy workflow might work at least for initial, they really just want to see like their holdings linked to items and they can hit the request button. And so to my mind, like we could probably use their production tenants in with the copy workflow and see if it meets their needs, but I guess there's probably a pretty good chance that we'll end up needing to refine things for this use case, but
That sounds like me.
yeah. Okay. sorry for the derailment there. I just that meeting is coming up after this, so it's on my brain. Okay, anything on ebooks before we move on ebook ILL? All right. I don't think Giannis is here. Jason, how are things going for you?
Oh, things are going okay. Getting back into it. Talking to Alan was a little bit interesting yesterday. That's a lot.
Good word for it.
Yeah,
But, like, cool if we can get there.
yeah, I was just thinking I should pull over. So the context for this is that Alan and Seb, I believe, had a power meeting session during a flight layover to talk about the potential of a new directory. And Alan has scoped a variety of individual directory entries versus consortial entries and then various networks. And yeah, it's like they're definitely like more complex than what we have up to now had. And he's going to write a README file that kind of explains like how these all would interact with each other and what exactly they capture. But please go ahead, Jason. I don't know if you have questions or things you want to. I know Jakob's not here, so I don't know how much we really want to get into it, but
So So I did have a comment about mod DNS that I was reminded of here that I should mention because I've not told anyone here about this, but I did notice somewhere along the way that the MinIO project has made some decisions. They made some stuff more proprietary. They have some licensing kerfuffle. I don't know the details, but a lot of people are abandoning it. They stopped publishing Docker images, and a bunch of other stuff. Now, we don't use the entirety of MinIO, which is sort of like a run your own S3 thingy. We don't use its interface or whatever else, but we use its Go library as an S3 client. And we were mod DMS. And I do think I used its Docker image in the integration test for that. So I wonder if the tests still run, and I haven't circled back to do that because I tend to always have actual work that's more immediately pressing to do than hypothetical maintenance. So that's a maybe a thing. I don't know too much more, but I didn't spend much more time on it than that, but there's that possibility that exists.
I was like,
Other
maybe that
else have
would be
been.
worthy of just capturing in an issue somewhere, and just keep it in the back of our minds.
Yeah, maybe. And maybe just like a run the integration test, for example. Yeah, so at least then we have something to point at. Yeah, I can do that. Otherwise, I finally did get, I don't remember what ticket number it was, but it's the ZFL wanting to have 4,000 directory entries and not being able to use that in the faceted filter thing, because that's capped at 1,000 pretty hard. And so I have it doing like a search as you type thing now, and there was a component for that. And I tried not spending so much time on that, but when it seemed like it was almost enough, I wrote it up, and then Tara immediately pushed back with like, well, this probably would be an issue. For example, like I didn't stash the state somewhere that it would survive between switching apps, that kind of thing. So you would lose your filter labels pretty readily. But it's still workable, just a bit clunky. And so I elaborated like a couple of long comments there, but where it landed is this. Now I ended up spending couple more days on it. Now it works about as well as it can, but there is a limitation with the piece of folio that we're using for it. And I filed a folio issue that it will say no matches found. Even if it's currently searching for a match, or if it really hasn't found any matches, or while you're still typing and it hasn't run the first search yet. In fact, if you just drop it down, it says no matches found. So I think that the fact that it's there from the beginning actually makes that a bit less confusing, but it's not great. However, they can actually use it to function with 4,000 libraries in that facet and make use of it to filter by any one of them, which I think is a vast improvement over their current situation where the system is unusable for them. So I hope it's sufficient. The next step would be to copy that component from Stripe's components and fork it in UIRS and then modify it to behave better asynchronously. But I don't know if this warrants that kind of extra effort when I've already kind of spent more time on it than I think we wanted me to.
I know Tara's been out sick, so she probably hasn't had a chance to review it. But I think she would have a better sense from the customer what what is this now workable? It's got to be better than what they have, so I assume that that should be something that they would want to just move forward with, but I'd wait to hear from her, I guess.
And I have to circle back with David I because there's kind of a weird deployment situation with ZFL stuff to get this out to them, or if we want to get this even tested in the versions they're using, because SLNP1, which is the most convenient to deploy to, is running a pre-ZFL version of Stripe's reshare, and you can see there's untranslated strings and stuff. But I think the post-ZFL version actually has a high enough major version, and I don't think we pin that anywhere. So I think we might just wind up fetching the absolute newest, which is fine. In that case, some of these problems should disappear because, like, yeah, one issue is a recent patch that Kurt made. He used a thing from a newer version of Stripe's reshare as well. So on SLNP1, when you actually click one of the thingies or one of the requests, thingies, whatever, it just fails because it doesn't have the function it thinks it ought to. So that's hopefully not a problem once we get that deployment sorted properly. And I don't think it would be a problem for actual production based on what I think we're using, but I don't know that. And it'd be nice to know that because I don't want that to actually happen to them, but I don't think it would. I don't think we'd let that happen.
Like, is there a chance we would have to go in and make the code work without the
The use setting
query
hook?
that, yeah.
I don't know, basically, because as far as I know, UIRS uses a caret dependency, which is just locking the major version and then just getting the newest minor and patch version. And so I think that'll probably pull the current Stripe's reshare, because regardless for ZFL, they need at least two. Something, and then it's just a bit a later version of Stripe's reshare 2 that had the use setting hook. The wrinkle in that might be to what extent we're making use of yarn lock files, where you have this like this idea of reproducible builds. Where it's got an actual hash of each package. It's like, no, we really have the same software we did last time we built this. And so, to the extent that we're using that for our production deployments, it's conceivable that they have it locked to a version of Stripe's reshare that is post version 2 where all the ZFL stuff came in there, but before. I don't know, June or July or whenever it was that I put the use setting hook in. So that's something I need to verify with David I, and I can get back to you.
Yeah, If there ends up needing to be something that he needs to adjust, I would just ask him to make a ticket to track it if you don't mind asking him to.
Sure. No problem. But it may not be something. So the real complexity is it may not be something he needs to adjust only, because it is the case that they deploy their own, right?
Correct.
So I guess if we guess you could adjust the documentation or something, but then I don't know if we want them to stop using their lock file and suddenly get new versions of everything. That could be opening Pandora's box. So we might be better off spending the time to work around not having that use setting hook. I don't think that's going to be too big of a lift. But I'll know more once I talk to him.
Okay, thank you for chasing that down. That sounds like a good thing to get a handle on.
Yeah, no problem. There's another set of file issues that I don't remember being assigned to me, but it seems to have been, so I looked at it. About hiding the create request button. And I'm pretty sure we talked about that a million years ago, and we're like, hey, it's just a permission. You can set that however you want. And Tara even surmised that's likely the case in the comments there. So I confirmed, yes, it is just a permission. You can set the permission for can create a request and choose what users you want to see the create button or not. But there was another part to the issue where they also wanted to hide some particular setting from the settings. And we don't really do that. And that might actually be fairly involved to implement kind of that kind of granularity. Yanis did, I think it was Yanis, maybe it was Edges, I can't remember. Someone in Latvia did some work to make it possible to hide a settings section. And that's these feature flags that we're using for ZFL. And there isn't one for the request default section that they were talking about, but we could add one relatively easily, and then we could hide that entire section. So I asked if it would be okay if we just hid that section, and so Tara can also follow up on that. And with that, I marked it in review.
I think I agree with you. Like I think getting down to like individual hiding individual permissions is a little excessive. So hopefully they will be okay with hiding that section. It's wonder like are people really going in and messing with the request prefix? Like that just seems wild, but I guess that could happen.
They don't, as far as I know, they don't pay us by the hour for this stuff, so we should probably maybe work with Tara and gently push back on something that just seems to, when it meanders into the realm of the silly, we should just push
And
back.
that's why I didn't do
Yeah, I
it.
think that seems smart.
Okay, thank you
But
for
the
looking at that. Go ahead.
Yeah, but the setting section hiding part, we already kind of do that for them. So if they want to hide another section, I think that, and it's not too big of a deal, I think we might do that
Sure,
as
yeah.
just general goodwill or whatever, because like it's not too far out of our way, and we've already gone down that road and have a whole pattern for it. But it seems like maybe there's some of their users they just shouldn't be giving settings access to, because there's a permission for that.
Yes. Yeah, there's a
And that
couple
might be
ways
just,
around this.
It might be useful for us in general, however, to understand what they're doing with it that requires them to grant settings to some users. Like, what subset, and it seems like a fairly small subset of settings, do they feel those new users need to be able to change at will? That seems interesting to know.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much Tara knows about that, or if they would be willing to like spell it out for us, but that seems, yeah, could be useful.
Yeah. Otherwise, the last thing, which was, I think, something that Jakob might have hoped I had more time to work on, we're getting tied up in all that, was making UIRS talk to the new requests thingy in CrossLink Broker. And so I took a look at that and I had some questions and I asked Jakob yesterday and sounds pretty encouraging. Like I couldn't see, for example, there's no CQL for requests yet. There's no way to filter that list. But it turns out he does something based on the tenant. So it will actually just show you requests for your institution somehow. So it's got that internally. And there is a, and I did see there's a boolean on there for whether it was request or a supplier. So that's enough to start into it and just get the request list and display and whatever else going somewhere. But I have various questions and trepidations around that, and I don't know if that's worth chatting about too much at length here, but I can mull on it myself and prototype something, or maybe once I have a bite to eat, I can talk to Seb for a bit or something just to have someone to bounce ideas off of and come to a reasonable place.
I see a thumbs up from Seb. That sounds good. Food probably will help.
It usually does.
okay. Well, anything else for now, or do you want to pass it
Stop
over to
hassling you
Kurt?
guys. I did have one more thing in
Yeah.
service of making the new UIRS thingy. I would be curious to know from Ian, what the state of the Reshare 2 environment is, maybe some, what I think the credentials are probably in LastPass. I just need to know what it's called, possibly. And maybe find out what the URL for the broker service is, because I think the request management is all tied in under the broker, so that I can actually try to create some requests, or maybe you've already got some requests created in there, so that I can attempt to list them and display them.
Sure, yeah. It's called Reshare 2 in LastPass. Let me find that. See how I spell that.
Yeah, all one string, space,
Yeah, I mean, I
dash.
had to mix it up a little bit because it's called Reshare 2, all one string, TWO.
Ah, okay.
And that's in LastPass where all the rest of the ones are. And let me look up what the broker URL is or what's going on with that. Hold on just a sec.
And actually, if you just paste this on the channel, I'll probably have an easier time finding that than wherever I stash notes for this.
Okay, I can do that.
Awesome, thanks. And yeah, sorry, that's everything.
Right, thanks, Jason. Hey, Kurt, how are things going?
Going all right. I don't have a whole lot new to report since I've been. I kind of took a kind of the end of the year. I had to take care of some folio stuff that had been sitting for a while, so I I've been kind of finishing that up. So I don't have a whole lot of new progress on this stuff. Some stuff is kind of in limbo, like the mechanism for the protected fields. I have a pull request that kind of demonstrates that, but then we don't really have many real protected fields, so it's kind of waiting on getting the final directory schema before it's actually like implemented in any real fashion. And I guess the whole term in the schema thing with the directory is potentially big, right? Especially if we're going to incorporate any of Alan's ideas or not. But I think once we know what the fields are going to be, it's going to be fairly. I can move forward with actually putting the protection for them.
Yeah, I think we need to have Jakob's eyes on the directory stuff before we proceed. I don't know if he's had a chance to review Alan's work yet, but I know we're waiting for Alan to supply that README as well, which I think will help.
He's
Okay, so.
shared a little bit of his work. I haven't looked at it in super detail. I think managing mutual expectations in terms of what we need concretely for reshare versus what's kind of suitable for partly what informs Alan's thinking is working on ISO 18626, right, and needing and being interested in having some type of project community neutral model of a directory. And some of that is, at least in the conversations I've had with him, it's not been obvious to me. While it feels like it would be really useful to have a project neutral description of a library or an institution, it isn't obvious to me that there is a need for all of the internal mechanics of networks and tiers to be captured in an open standard because they depend on the mechanics of the consortial platform, and trying to force a single model down over the all potential consortial resource sharing systems might limit what could be done inside of a consortium, which doesn't seem so useful. So I guess I would think that one way to approach conversations with him about this is to sort of look for the opportunity to have a more shared data model for describing institutions and to talk about what that needs in terms of openness to support a consortial directory of some sorts. And then if there is a conversation about an open directory model for the consortium itself, then maybe kind of nudge back at that a little bit. I don't know if that makes sense or that at all matches. So I'm kind of sorry I missed those conversations, but that's kind of how I've approached those conversations with them a little bit.
I think
Yeah,
also
that fits with.
when he had he said he was gonna write up some README stuff and like how he expected
Yeah.
things to be used, which I think hopefully will might provide at least a jumping off point for how we look at it and whether how much of it we want to take on in terms of incorporating it.
There's also the tension around, and I think Alan alluded to that in a Slack message to me yesterday, that we have been thinking about how to use our directory as a sort of central point of configuration for the consortium. And he tends to think about it as a sort of a public or sharing mechanism. And I don't know that we've even ourselves sort of fully wrapped our heads around the tension around what that looks like.
Yeah, so
Well,
when I
those are
asked,
just two different things.
right? I mean, when I asked him yesterday, about his, were any of the fields and stuff, like, protected or private. He pretty much said that everything he had in mind would be openly viewable, and he had it would seem like he would need like a different mechanism in order to manage any kind of secrets, which means that if we were having like configuration values and other things like that in it, we would need some other way to do that.
But also, what are we, how are we thinking about what it is that he's proposing? Is he proposing a system or a schema? And if it's a schema, then it doesn't seem crazy that we would have extensions to that schema in the way that we implement it, for instance, right? So and maybe the model could even be that there is in a public schema for information about a library, there could be something as simple as a URL that would retrieve embedded in a directory entry that would retrieve stuff that is private to that library or something, or a separate API endpoint that would give you the stuff that's private to that library. I don't know that including an encrypted blob in a public directory entry, that feels I think that had come up in some conversations internally here, but that feels like kind of waving your secrets in front of people, and maybe that's
Yeah,
not the
that
way
does
to
seem
go.
weird to me.
Yeah, it just feels fishy.
I
But
think that was Kayan's idea from the.
I wasn't it, I mean that I feel like that came up, and that I'm like, here's it just feels strange. But it doesn't seem at all strange to say, oh, here's a UI, or here's a link to a private information that requires a key or something.
Yeah, so when I in a conversation yesterday, one thing I asked was how, because it wasn't clear from that, is how this would actually how it would actually flow in practice. Like what parts of this are hosted at ISIL or somewhere kind of central for just general discovery. And then because he mentioned it was decentralized, but like it wasn't quite clear. So he indicated URLs, and so that's where I suggested maybe just some prose kind of walking us through some different corner cases that illustrate how this would flow would be useful. So he's gonna do that. And yeah, I mentioned that we were making it using the directory for configuration of secrets and just more generally. And so there need to be some kind of extensibility if we're gonna adopt this shape. And so I was thinking about that, hopefully. And it also seemed like this is mainly useful if there's actual adoption of it. And I suggested that maybe rather than kind of promoting the whole thing at once, that it might be good to kind of get the simplest, least objectionable version of this out there and expand from that point.
And that to me would seem to be sort of basic information about the library.
Yeah. And maybe even some of its endpoints and stuff, but like just stuff that anybody would be comfortable just publishing.
Great.
Because that's how I'd always thought of this, is just like a standard for library to publish machine-readable information about itself as an institution.
I was also the I one thing I did push back on in what he shared with me was a schema that included that non-controversial information, but also included information about memberships in consortia, where it felt I guess my gut feeling is still that just from an organizational perspective, the library doesn't really get to say what organization it's a member of in any way that's sort of that is actionable. That's the organization gets to decide who its members are. And that's a little bit like, to me, that throws me back into the conversations we had about the directory in Trove. Right, where we ended up with the network and tier memberships living in a kind of membership node that sat in between the library.
Well, he has kind of membership node in his schema.
Well, so maybe
Is
part of
this.
the issue is also that the guy's not a developer, right? He's a really strong SME for sure, that maybe in some cases knows enough about technology to get him into trouble, sort of like me. And so he may need a little friendly nudge to figure out where stuff goes to make it actionable or to make it sort of fit what we need it to be.
Yeah, he has sort of pieces there. You'd see that he's been exposed to these ideas, he's been thinking about it, but yeah, I'm not quite sure how it fits together. So I'm very curious to see this readme.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and I'll just say he did reiterate like this is really like this was like just drafty, like very drafty, and that he was trying to just present the SME feedback that he had received in a way that would be digestible by us. And I think this is probably more useful than the slide deck that you know didn't have notes on decisions that were made and stuff. So I think that's where this is partially coming from, is just to try to relay what he heard in a in the SME meetings and whatnot.
That makes sense. That's probably a good way to look at it.
Beyond drafty though, didn't he say something like this was a fever dream on antibiotics?
It did come up a few times, yeah.
Well,
How's
then
that for a disclaimer?
he messaged me privately and was like, I'm so sorry if I wasn't making sense. And I was like, no, I think it's okay. Like but yeah, that's you know what happens when you're sick and trying to work on things, but
Yeah.
He really appreciated the having or doing this because it helped him distract himself from being sick. So if nothing else comes of it, he got that out of it.
Right. I can think of better ways to entertain myself when I'm sick, but
And that's
to each
crazy
his own.
that's what you reach for, right? You know.
All right, 2 minute warning for us, Mary.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, Seb and I have a 10 o'clock we gotta run too.
Okay,
But
so
Kurt,
real quick, I got a
is there anything else?
question.
Yeah.
The request context injection, Jason, is that still worth doing? Like, even though we're not using it right now, is it still something you think that's going to come up again? Should I implement that?
I don't know. Jakob seemed keen on it. It makes sense to me as a thing that we will at some point or another want to have. Like that seems to be a fairly major limitation of that OAPI code gen, that it's like, oh, well, we've the you shouldn't be you shouldn't have access to the HTTP request because in the strict mode, you should specify in the spec everything that you want to get. And that's where you would specify potentially, I think, even headers. And so, because you can use that to surface headers to yourself, I think they would say, well, what else do you need from that? But can you surface headers? I mean, I know you can surface get params.
I don't know. Okay, I'll look at it and see. I mean, it sounds worthy. I'll go ahead and just take a stab at it.
At doing it or at seeing whether you can like
Well,
understanding better the use case and like
I'll
what.
first take a look at the, get a, better sense of what's going on, and then, yeah, so it seems like it's worthy.
But I think even if the code gen lets you say this endpoint is interested in these headers, and we'll surface those when requested that way. It might be that there are other reasons we need to access the request object. And certainly there's probably going to be some reasons where we need to access the response object, although I think we get to build that. Or maybe it's just the case that strict mode is too strict and we shouldn't be using it. But it does a bunch of other stuff for us.
Yeah,
And
well,
so I
let
think
me
that's
take
where
a
he was
look
coming
at
at it from,
the
was as a kind of a compromise where we can have our cake and eat it too. Like we can use our strict mode, and if we need this other stuff, we can access those objects in the context.
Yeah, I guess I need to go look a little closer and see like what strict mode and how it differs from non-strict mode. Let's see what we're getting from that?
That's definitely relevant context for this.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll start there then and maybe circle back.
I loved your response to that, by the way. That's exactly what that pun deserved.
All right.
Yeah, see you
Guess
guys.
yeah, I guess everyone's gone. Talk to you later.
Yeah, they went to their meeting.
Yeah.
That's good.
All right.
Later.